Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A24-0434, State of Minnesota versus Gerald Edward Holster. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent, we would appreciate it. We are recording the oral argument here today, and that helps with the recording. Also, there is a clock available on the podium, and the podium is adjustable. So, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Gerald Holster. Principal claim in this appeal challenging Mr. Holster's burglary convictions is that his conviction was wrongfully obtained by the erroneous admission of the out-of-court statements of the two accusatory witnesses. The issue the district court based that decision on was what is known as forfeiture by wrongdoing, which I would just briefly outline here by noting under the cases I cited, Giles v. California from the U.S. Supreme Court and State v. Cox from our Supreme Court, that it requires four findings. First, that the declarant witnesses are actually unavailable. If that is found, it must be determined whether the defendant engaged in wrongful conduct in any of his actions or words. Thirdly, the question must be answered whether any such wrongful conduct actually procured or caused, according to State v. Shaka, the unavailability of the witness, and then finally, whether that was the defendant's intent.
Counsel, let's separate the two witnesses, which I think the district court should have done, but didn't do. When it comes to BB, we're gonna go by initials here.
All right then.
She was subpoenaed, correct?
Yes.
All right. There's testimony from an officer that there were several phone calls made by the defendant to her. That is correct as well?
Yes, and the phone calls were admitted, which was another issue in my appellate
true.
Brief.
True, but presuming that they were admissible at this stage, he asks her if she's going to attend trial. He tells her, I don't think you should. That arguably is wrongful conduct. He goes on to tell her a few other things, like tells BB if she doesn't go to trial, I'll give her any space or anything else she needs, anything she wants. She won't have any problems with him. I'll just come to a quick conclusion and say, why isn't Mr. Holster guilty of making her unavailable? I'm talking about BB now.
Before I answer that question, I would like to restate that there needed to be a threshold finding that the witness was actually unavailable and that the state had made the proper good faith efforts to produce that witness. I noticed respondent did not address that issue at all. I consider that point conceded.
Okay, but she was served a subpoena.
Great. She was. Okay. But the question that Cox and Trifoletti that I'm relying on explore is not just whether the witness didn't appear, but whether that witness was actually unavailable, and whether if they did appear, they would refuse to testify.
Let me turn that around then, because I want to be clear as to your position. Is it your position that in that situation that the proceeding should stop and law enforcement should go to the last known address where she was subpoenaed and look for?
Only because that's happened so many times in the various cases that I've cited. Numerous cases that I cited.
So that should be a requirement to prove unavailability. Not just a subpoena, but a follow-up investigation day of, if necessary, to get her to come to court.
Your Honor, the requirement is that the state has to make good faith efforts, which Trifoletti characterized as exhausting certain avenues. No decision has ever claimed that one method is a requirement. The issue here is whether the state made good efforts. There were none made. The prosecutor did not make any calls. He did not ask, for a bench warrant, as has been done in many cases. He did not ask for a patrol to go by the house again, at least to bring in BB, nothing. And that requires more. And I think Trifoletti and Cox make that very clear. The judge in Cox actually held a hearing on whether the witness would appear. That is the threshold requirement. And these witnesses cannot be deemed unavailable when all the state did the morning of trial was say, they're not coming, I assert forfeiture by wrongdoing. That's all that happened. So once we get past that, then there's the whole separate issue of whether if BB and PM had been produced, was there any proof that they would then fail to testify? Neither of those were found or addressed by respondent in her brief.
That's kind of a circular argument, though, isn't it? Because you have to have them there to do that, to know that. And that goes back to the question of, are they truly unavailable?
Which is why the issues are addressed sequentially. The district court first had to establish whether the witnesses were actually unavailable. The state made no showing than they were, other than saying, they're not here, let's do forfeiture by wrongdoing. That's it. That's all the record has. That's why there's the primary error here that I believe drives the error made in the finding of forfeiture by wrongdoing, before we even get to the issue of procurement. But I am ready to address that now, if you'd permit me to do so. I need to point out, as I did in my brief, that the first call that actually spoke about BB's testimony was the September 26th call. And 47 seconds into the call, and this is discussed at page 115 of the transcript, Mr. Bolster asked, are you coming? BB replied, no. That stated her own intent right then and there, before there was ever any discussion about Mr. Bolster's complaints about evidence being put in against him, how much it would be better if she didn't come. Her mind was already made up. The standard from Cox, Giles, and Shaka that the district court here relied on is that the defendant has to have caused the non-appearance of the witness. BB had already made her mind up, Your Honor. That's right in the record. It's right in the call. When the detective went on to discuss her review of the call, she mischaracterized it during a sequence in which BB said, I am. Mr. Bolster immediately said, what? I thought you just said you weren't. She explained, I meant I was referring that I'm the only one who received a subpoena. BB at no point ever indicated any desire to offer testimony in this trial. And the Shaka case that the district court relied on showed that that witness fully intended to testify. She even called the morning of trial saying, I'll be there. But what happened in that case was the defendant, and there was evidence of this in the record, sent family members to her home, where the family member, under his own words, told her to stay her dumb, I'll use the word self, home, an implicit threat. That's what the case law shows, that a defendant is subject to this narrow exception of forfeiture by wrongdoing when he procures, when he causes the absence of a witness, and it has consistently been through either, well, in some cases, killing the witness, threats of violence, or other kinds of assurances that specifically are meant to make the witness not appear. And the sequence that you just referred to that respondent does cite, where Mr. Bolster told her about how he promised that he would treat her better, there was no part of that sequence in which he said it would be if you don't come. In exchange for you not coming, he just said that when I get out, I promise you I'll be better. That was speaking about their marriage, Your Honor, not about whether she had already made her mind up. So under the test that has to be applied here, the district court's ruling must be seen as erroneous and impacting Mr. Bolster's fundamental right, which I would add he did object to. He stated on the record that he did not want these out-of-court statements used against him. He said, quote, I want to cross-examine these witnesses. Even though he wasn't a lawyer, he spoke directly to the right at stake. And that's why I dispute respondents' claim that there was never any objection made here, because under Rule 103 of the Rules of Evidence, it says if the context of the objection is clear from the words used, that suffices. Mr. Bolster could not have been any more clear that he did not want the state to simply play the tape that he could not cross-examine. So he was right, and I believe the district court was wrong on that issue. And if you accept the fact, as it must be in the tape, that Ms. Bolster, that BB had made up her mind, then there's no evidence here that Mr. Bolster caused or procured anything. That's demonstrated in the record, and as the law must be applied, this admission of these out-of-court statements was erroneous. Unless there are other aspects of that issue the court would like me to address?
I do have a question, and that's if we disagree with you with regard to BB, but we agree with you with regard to PM, is it harmless error?
It is not. Either witness would be a violation of the confrontation right, which in itself is a fundamental denial. And whether both witnesses were available or they weren't, the use of both statements is on the state. It's not on Mr. Bolster. But I mean, I admit that the issue largely revolves around BB, but I must rest on the law and the record that I've just cited to answer Judge Cleary's questions to point out that that is the primary issue and it is the biggest demonstration of error.
And then it is clear from the record that the state had these recordings from these telephone conversations before trial, correct?
Yes.
So the state would have been aware prior to trial that BB had said she did not intend to come.
It would certainly appear so, yes.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add that I did cite State v. King, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2000, which specifically held that the mere service of a subpoena is not sufficient. The state has to make more efforts before they even get to the question of whether the defendant caused the absence of the witness. I would lastly then address my argument about the appointment of, or I should say, the non-appointment of advisory counsel by stating that I based my claim of structural error on the case I cited for the rule and at the beginning of my argument, which was State v. Gant, which was actually from this court in 2023, that if there is an invalid waiver and a corresponding denial of the right to counsel, this is structural error that requires reversal. With that framework, I then rely.
So just the time left is limited, so I want to ask you a couple of questions about your argument on the waiver issue. You would agree that the case law, Clark, says defendants don't have a constitutional right to counsel.
Yes.
And your concern is that the district court did not advise Bolster on the benefits of advisory counsel.
Well,
Go ahead.
Specifically, that the district court did not actually offer standby counsel.
The district court did ask Bolster on more than one occasion if he wanted advisory counsel.
Yes, the district court did, but that's not offering it. And that was the key fact that the cases I'm relying on pointed out, specifically State v. Clark from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2006, in which it said that there is an invalid waiver if the district court at no point offers. I mean, in this case, the district court merely inquired, will you be seeking? And when Mr. Bolster made these equivocal comments or said, I think it's a great idea, but I just don't want it to get in my way, that was all that was done.
Well, I thought the district court indicated that it could look into getting advisory counsel, but it might delay the trial a bit, and Mr. Bolster said no, he didn't want any delay.
Again, only inquiring about whether Mr. Bolster was making a request. You know, the cases that have talked about getting a proper waiver are when the district court actually looks at the defendant as they should and say, defendant, I really think that you should have advisory counsel. The advisory counsel will at least be able to acquaint you with the rules and procedures you will be expected to follow. And that wasn't even really discussed. The district court simply brought it up saying, are you requesting advisory counsel? And Mr. Bolster said, sure, if it won't interfere with me. That's it. So that's why I think that this framework that Clark provided is appropriate and applicable here. And the waiver was invalid and incomplete. It's also very clear that Mr. Bolster really didn't understand the magnitude of the undertaking. He had never done it before. His rationale was, I've been represented before, it was unsatisfactory. And finally, the district court and the prosecutor, as I believe the Clark case explored, never offered any of the kind of reasonable but basic assistance that would be expected for a pro se defendant, further adding to the invalidity of the waiver. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel. May it please the court. I would like to first address a few matters that were just brought up by opposing counsel here related to the cases with forfeiture by wrongdoing. That's where I intend to spend most of the conversation on, but I do have two other points that I want to hit on the advisory counsel, as well as on harmless error.
Well, counsel, if you would respond as to BB and the argument made by counsel.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think one of the important things to look at, just starting from the first argument made by opposing counsel, is whenever we're looking at these matters, State v. Cox and State v. Trifletti were both cited. Whenever we look at those cases, they said it may require the state to exhaust all avenues. But whenever we look at these matters, both of those cases had a separate or higher requirement. So in Trifletti, it involved a COVID test. And so the court looked at it and said, this victim is unavailable, but due to a COVID test. So this is not due to witness tampering. This is a COVID test. During Cox, there was an evidentiary hearing beforehand at which the witness appeared, gave a statement saying that they were reluctant to testify, and then were released from a subpoena. So then the court looked at both of those and said, in Trifletti specifically, this could have been changed with time. If we'd waited longer, the court could have brought them in, or the prosecutor's office could have brought them in at the back end of the trial after the quarantine period. That's vastly different. As well,
why isn't that precisely what happened here, where a subpoena was served on BB, then a telephone call occurs where BB says, I'm not showing up. The state has that telephone call and therefore knows that there's some indication that their witness is not going to show up. Why doesn't that trigger an additional obligation to do something more than simply serve the subpoena?
Certainly, Your Honor. Whenever you look at this case, it's important to consider, again, breaking this apart from Cox, which was a murder, or Trifletti, in which the witness was just a bystander. This is a domestic violence matter. It's not charged as that. However, it's very clear from the record that domestic violence is at play. And that has been cited by the court, specifically in Giles. I'll read from it. It states, acts of domestic violence are often intended to dissuade a victim from resorting to outside help and include conduct designed to prevent testimony to police officers or cooperate. As well in Davis, which is another case that's cited by the state, it states that notoriously susceptible to intimidation or coercion of the victim to ensure that she does not testify at trial. I would also turn the court to...
I guess I don't understand how that case law goes to the obligation of the state to at least inquire as to whether this witness was going to show up after they had access to this telephone call.
Well, and certainly, Your Honor. And
I mean, why didn't the prosecutor at a minimum in order to exhaust some amount of obligation to ensure their witness shows up after they hear this phone call say, oh, man, I better call her and make sure she's planning to show up. And if not, you know, then proceed as necessary. But it does seem like the state was on notice that she was not going to show up and chose to sit on its hands.
And it could be perceived that way. However, again, in a domestic violence matter, and I think the timeline here matters, it's very common to have witnesses and victims because it is a unique situation where your witness is also the victim. And it's common to have them say that they won't come or say one thing to one person or the other to a different party. And that's what happened here.
Well, whenever counsel, go ahead.
Okay, that's fine.
Thanks. I don't disagree with anything you just said about DA cases, but Cox suggests that prosecutorial authorities have a good faith effort to obtain the presence of the witness at trial. And as Judge Larson was suggesting, I think given that the subpoena had been made and we knew from the phone call she wasn't going to show up, doesn't that demand follow-up of some sort, whether phone calls, whether a squad car out to the house? I mean, there's certainly been, that's been done in DA cases.
And it has, Your Honor. I think whenever you look at this case, though, unlike in Cox, unlike in Trifletti, unlike any other cases cited, we had a witness who, on one hand, in the case of PM, was actively avoiding service. She was telling people on the jail calls that I'm not going to be there, I'm avoiding law enforcement. On the case of BB, we had where she said, I won't be there, I won't testify, and that was after law enforcement had spoken to her and she was cooperative. And so, although, you know,
it have been, you know, a small undertaking for law enforcement to try and contact BB and ask her if she was going to appear?
It would have been a small requirement, Your Honor. However, whenever you look at this, it's not a requirement. And I think that's important.
But there is the case law suggests that there needs to be a good faith effort to obtain presence of the witness at trial. And so it's, I mean, to the excellent questions by the two other judges here, it's unclear to me how there is a good faith effort if there's no action by law enforcement after hearing these recordings to try and ensure the witness is, you know, to determine whether the witness truly is unavailable.
Certainly, Your Honor. Again, I rest on the argument that that's not the standard. Whenever we look at good faith in these other cases, there's cases where parties have not been subpoenaed, and that was allowed. That's Reynolds, which is a very old case citing this, as well as other cases where law enforcement in subpoenaing an individual is going the sufficient distance. So even though we're unaware or aware, either way, that they may not appear, until they don't appear, that's one issue. But this was not a case where there was an evidentiary hearing, where there was a prior hearing. We have to look at the full context of this, where law enforcement speaks with Brittany Bolster, and she's cooperative.
Counsel, you raised the issue, even though it's a first-degree burglary conviction, of the domestic assault aspects to this. That arguably should have put the prosecution on notice of how uncooperative domestic abuse victims often become when something gets close to trial. Going back to Cox and the good faith duty to ensure presence at trial, I'm going to keep coming back, as I think the other judges are, to it looks like a failure to do that on the behalf of the state. We haven't even got to PM yet, which is a whole other issue. But in terms of BB, even BB, it looks like a failure.
And, Your Honor, again, with this being a domestic abuse, sure there is that situation where law enforcement could go out, perform additional follow-up, get phone calls, get a warrant. However, usually in domestic violence cases, it's not the standard to go out and get a warrant for a victim, especially a victim who's being threatened. And that's where I think I keep coming back to consider this in the domestic abuse situation. I'm not saying it's a lower standard, but we have a standard that doesn't define what good faith is. And then we have a very known fact
I think Cox defines it as reasonableness, and I think that there are certainly intervening steps here that could have been taken prior to issuing a warrant for the victim to try to procure her.
And certainly, Your Honor, such as stopping by the house. But I think I go back again. This is in the record. It's from the jail calls. Law enforcement was stopping by trying to subpoena PM multiple times a day. Law enforcement had gone out to the house. There's only so many steps that you can take before it moves almost into harassment. And whenever we look at this, this is a sort of a test of who is prejudiced here. Mr. Bolster absolutely has a constitutional right to confrontation. But the case law is very clear that he does not have the right to intervene or to try to disrupt the state's normal process. In a normal trial, it's accepted that a subpoena will have somebody appear, or that sending officers repeatedly to a house would result in a subpoena. This is not the state that has prejudiced Mr. Bolster in his right of confrontation. This is Mr. Bolster's actions in interfering and attempting to get the victims not to appear, which is what happened.
Do you disagree with appellant's argument that we first have to evaluate the unavailability of the witness before we get to wrongful conduct?
I do believe, Your Honor, that is correct. So whenever you look at the case law, it is four factors. I think you start at the beginning and go through. But again, that unavailability is a very low bar. There are cases where individuals were not subpoenaed, that they were found to be unavailable. There's multiple domestic abuse cases that are cited in both briefs, where whenever you look at the context, there were not further efforts made, and that's sufficient. Because it does go back to how much effort does the state have to put in, and it's considered a reasonable good faith effort. There was multiple law enforcement officers who stopped by PM's house. There was multiple contacts with BB, including her providing more evidence before these calls. That's a cooperative witness. That's someone who's providing more evidence whenever law enforcement speaks with them. They are present. They are engaging in the process. Then there's the phone calls, and it steps out. And so just on that unavailability, law enforcement could have done more, but I don't think they're required to under the standard.
You raised PM, so we might as well address that. There was an attempt to serve as subpoena, apparently, but that was never served, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. It's not clear, from what I could ascertain, how many times that attempt was made and whether the state ever made contact.
Your Honor, I don't have an exact number. However, from
this is from the record now. This is from the record?
Yeah, there's not an exact number from the record. However, again, the district court is able to look at the full facts of this. They're able to look at it, and that's where in Shaka they talk about making a leap to determine. That is the situation here. We're looking at repeated contacts, standard forms of service. Law enforcement talks about going to the house. Detective Radosevich is at the house. She talks about it. And then also in the jail calls, they talk about how many times law enforcement is going out. And if there's no further questions on that, I do see the time is running low. I would like just to address briefly harmless error. I'm not conceding that PM is not validly unavailable. I think the case law is clear that you don't have to have a party subpoenaed. Whenever we look at the cases that were cited by the defense, specifically with their mention of Cox, again, this is a situation where the court didn't get to it. They found it on other grounds. So whenever we look at specifically PM, her testimony, I think, validly comes in. If it didn't, this is still not harmless error. And I would point the court to a couple different facts here. Most notably, that the standard for this, and I'm going to quote from State v. Lobach, is that a defendant claiming error in the trial court's reception of evidence has the burden of showing both the error and the prejudice from the error. A reversal is warranted only when the error substantially influences the jury to convict. And we look at some of the cases we've talked about today, they talk about this harmless error, specifically Trifoletti, where there was a wrongful admission of testimony, but it was found to be harmless in part because it was corroborative and paralleled the already present testimony. In this case, whenever we look at the testimony from PM and from BB, just in time as they were taken by the officers, they were very close. They talked to BB, then they turn around and take PM's statement. As well, both these statements were incredibly concise. There was not anything added from PM that's really not mentioned in BB. As well, as part of this, I went through the record and read through the actual statements that were produced and argued by the state in opening and closing. There is 1 to 2 sentences that come from PM's testimony. Everything else is directly from BB's testimony. That's a very small amount. And again, it's parallel to BB's testimony, and it's corroborative. And one of the things that we look at that is State v. Rosberg, which is the case that discusses this exact matter. And they state that not only was the other evidence of Rosberg's guilt overwhelming, but the testimony about Hawkins being afraid of Rosberg added little to the undisputed testimony. That's finding that it was not harmless error to have this testimony admitted. And again, that is what we have here. This added very little to the testimony. The state did not dwell on it in opening or closing. It was, at most, corroborative. As well, State v. Blanchard holds a similar error harmless when the state of mind evidence was merely cumulative. Whenever we look at PM's testimony, it is cumulative, it is corroborative, and it's parallel to what would have come into the record through Brittany, through BB. And as well with that, that's what the state used as the strength of its case, and including the fact that although Mr. Bolster was convicted on both counts, he was sentenced on count one. Count one was specifically just BB. Count two was PM. So whenever we look at this harmless error assessment, this did not add anything meaningful to the opening or closing. It did not add anything meaningful to the jury's discussion about this, except for perhaps that two people said the same statement. And again, it was not a long statement.
I guess just to flip it on its head, though, you would agree that if BB's statement improperly came in, that was not harmless, correct?
If BB's statement, correct.
If that was improper. So you're saying PM, if BB was fine, but PM was not, that's harmless, but you would agree that it was not harmless if BB's statement improperly.
Correct, Your Honor. I think whenever we look at BB's testimony, that really is what brought most of the elements into the case. I think without that, you have trespass, a few other minor offenses. BB's testimony was instrumental to this case. With that, Your Honor, I would just use my remaining time to briefly touch on the conversation about the admission of jail calls for the evidentiary hearing. I think it's important to note here that this is in the district court's ability to admit this evidence. It's at the discretion of the court. It's controlled by Rule 901A. This is talking about, and that's Minnesota Rule of Evidence 901A. That is what allows district court judges to bring evidence in. It's not the same threshold as a jury trial where you would have to bring in and lay foundation for the jail calls, the recordings, a technical specialist. This is a pretrial ruling determining admissibility. It went through the court very properly in that matter. One final thing that I just want to mention on in regards to the arguments with that pretrial hearing, it was mentioned that the district court judge should have split it whenever they were doing the assessment for forfeiture wrongdoing between BB and PM. In reviewing the transcript for that, the district court did. They go through, they make the assessment around BB, then there's a comment by the prosecutor, Your Honor, we'd also like this to apply to PM, and the district court judge reruns through those factors. Applying that. There's a written order that came out of it. I think it's valid to say that both were assessed separately by the court.
Can you just briefly respond to appellant's argument that the waiver of counsel wasn't valid?
Yes, Your Honor. Just give me one moment. So whenever we look at the waiver of counsel issue, I think it's important to note again, this is not a constitutional right to advisory counsel. At this point in the trial, Jared Bolster had gone through a waiver with a public defender.
Can you just specifically focus on whether the district court made an offer of advisory counsel, and if not, whether the waiver wasn't sufficient?
Certainly, Your Honor. It was not insufficient, and the district court did make a waiver. They offered to him on the record two separate parts, both on the Monday pretrial hearing, on the Tuesday of trial. It's in the record, it's in the transcript. They discuss advisory counsel. Mr. Bolster at that point is representing himself. It's his right to decide how to run his case, and he states that he doesn't want to delay. Mr. Bolster does have a right to a speedy trial. I don't think there's any situation in which the district court could have told him, no, we're going to continue this, get you advisory counsel, without violating his speedy trial right. If they'd done that, I think we'd be back here arguing that his rights were violated. So again, the district court has the ability to appoint advisory counsel. The rules say may appoint. And there's a series of that they go through to look at it. It's whether the trial is going to be overly complex, whether there's a concern for disruption, whether the defendant who's seeking advisory counsel could be removed.
I think we're aware of the...
Certainly, Your Honor. But none of those factors make that requirement. And whenever you look at the district court had no concern about that, still made the offer. And so I believe that it was both a valid waiver of counsel and that advisory counsel was not required, as well the final point on that being Mr. Bolster, it was his choice not to have advisory counsel because he wanted to proceed with the case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sorry to interrupt, but before we proceed, I'll just note that respondent's counsel never identified himself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you identify yourself for the record and the party you're representing?
Joseph Williamson. I'm assistant Dakota County attorney here on behalf of the state of Minnesota, which is the respondent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Marshall. All right. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I just may begin, I would just like, first, I'm not sure why the person that wrote the state's brief is not here today, but the arguments being made here just now, first, that Trifoletti and Cox state that the standard is the state may be required to do reasonable efforts. That's not what they say. That is an exact and demanding standard and one that is required. The second claim that I did not see anywhere in respondent's brief that domestics don't usually involve sending a squad or just issuing a simple warrant, that I'm not aware of any authority for that. And as a former trial lawyer, I had many domestics where the prosecutor said, if the complainant is not here, we're sending a squad. So I don't think the court should consider any arguments that weren't raised in respondent's brief. The issue of the prejudice involved by allowing in these out-of-court statements that Mr. Bolster was not able to cross-examine, I found difficult to follow because Trifoletti and Cox are very clearly not, all right, let me just limit it to Trifoletti. The reason harmful error wasn't found in Trifoletti is because there was so much other evidence. That was a murder case, I believe, or I don't remember what the offense was. But in this case, this was all the evidence that the state had other than the admissions of Mr. Bolster, which, of course, this court knows can't be a basis for a conviction by itself. So beside that, all the state had was the tape of BB and PM. And trying to claim that PM was not significantly harmful testimony, she's the only one that said that Mr. Bolster grabbed the taser out of her hand and then used it on them or threatened to use it. She's the only one that established that element of the offense that happened inside the house. PM was an incredibly damaging witness who Mr. Bolster could not cross-examine. The harm here, given the fact that the state's evidence was essentially limited entirely to these two witnesses, could not have been greater. And it is because of that that even an uninformed layperson like Mr. Bolster could tell the court, I want to cross-examine these witnesses. He didn't get that chance. Unless there are any more questions, I think I covered what I wanted to on that. I just want to then wrap up again on the issue of standby counsel. I said it in my brief, but it's both Gant and Clark that talked about how offering counsel is part of a valid waiver process. I mean, I doubt I would have even raised the issue if I hadn't gone in and read both of those cases and saw that this court and the Supreme Court said there needs to be an offer. A close examination of the record will see here that no such offer was ever made. They were merely inquiries. And given the trial that ultimately ensued at one point with Mr. Bolster ultimately throwing up his hands saying, I can see that nothing I'm saying here is making any difference. Just, he had no help of any kind. The prosecutor sought to exploit his lack of knowledge by refusing to redact the inadmissible prejudicial statements in the jail calls. The examples that the prosecutor tried to cite that were actual help were not at all. I detailed that in my reply brief. The biggest one being that simply giving Mr. Bolster a laptop so he could play all the incriminating evidence against him is not help. For these reasons, I'm asking this court to reverse Mr. Bolster's convictions for the violation of his confrontation right and the error in the accepting of the waiver of counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today. They are helpful to the court. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.